So last week I was reading one of the Peter Rabbit books with my son, who's 2.5, and I came across a section where the farmer takes out a strap and straps Peter Rabbit for his bad behavior. And I was like, oh my goodness, my values have come home to roost now, haven't they? So I was like, you know, there are two ways to handle that, right? There's one way, which is to put away Peter Rabbit and say, I'm not going to read it to him because it's going to freak him out. And there's another way, which is just kind of like at a very basic level, even at 2.5, say, okay, so what he means here is that he's punishing Peter Rabbit and he's punishing him by hitting him, which is not really a nice thing to do. Let's talk about that a little bit. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, like in 2 years, he's going to be on the playground and he's probably going to hear worse things than a farmer strapping Peter Rabbit. So I'm better maybe personally, I think, to start building those skills now about engaging with things that we maybe don't agree with anymore and explaining why maybe they were considered to be socially acceptable at one time, but they aren't anymore.
That's Alexandra Yarrow, Program Manager at the Ottawa Public Library. Today, we're going to talk about the freedom to read and decisions to control the kind of information we have access to in books. Books are being pulled off of shelves in libraries and schools for an extensive list of reasons, many more complex than depicting the beating of Peter Rabbit. So last week, the Ottawa Public Library, or OPL as you'll hear it mentioned, held Freedom to Read Week. They opened their doors for in-person and online panels with esteemed authors to discuss censorship and intellectual freedom. Here to share more about Freedom to Read Week and the challenges seen in libraries across Canada is my conversation with OPL's Alexandra Yarrow.
So Freedom to Read Week is an annual event celebrated in Canada and organized by the Book and Periodical Council of Canada. So basically, it's an opportunity to talk about the importance of free expression in Canada. And in our case, we see it as an opportunity to kind of highlight the role of public libraries to protect and promote the freedom to read and think and have access to a really broad range of ideas and information, which is a cornerstone of democracy.
Mm-hmm. And the library celebrated this week by having speakers like journalist John Ibbotson and author Lawrence Hill speak. Can you tell me some of the key takeaways from events like that?
Yeah, sure. So we really, in the past few years, I'm going to take a little bit of a step back and then I'll come back specifically to the talks. Our board and staff at OPL have really reaffirmed their commitment to intellectual freedom. And part of that has been kind of developing new programs and resources to make sure that we kind of weave conversations about the free exchange of ideas into all of the things that we do. And so part of that was a lot of really great activities for Freedom to Read Week last week, as you mentioned. So the two in-person and live-streamed author talks with John Ibbotson and Lawrence Hill. Both of these authors have faced either challenges or, you know, have been involved in journalism that perhaps is contentious sometimes. So Lawrence Hill had his book, in fact, a book cover of his burned in the Netherlands many years ago. So we wanted to have folks come and talk at OPL who had experiences protecting and upholding the freedom of expression in Canada. And that's really what they focused on in their talks. They were very thoughtful talks. They touched on kind of the history of censorship, some of the well-meaning intentions that people have and, you know, really strong convictions that people have when they want to get a particular book or idea banned or censored. But then, you know, the reasons why this is sometimes not the best reaction to an idea that you disagree with or even an idea that you find really dangerous and harmful.
Mm-hmm. And Lawrence Hill, particularly author of The Book of Negroes, there was a huge outcry about that. Can we talk a little bit more about that, like cover burning and rewrites to his work?
Yeah, so from what I understand and from what I remember reading at the time, too, not just from his talk with us last week, the Book of Negroes takes its title, right? And I remember reading it when it came out from a specific historical document that actually was called that. And so, you know, while the term Negroes has fallen out of favor in many circles for very good reasons, it was in the title referring to a specific document that formed the basis of the books and, you know, told a kind of historical genealogical perspective. So, you know, because that term is no longer really socially acceptable or used, many people were really uncomfortable with the title. From what I understand from hearing Lawrence Hill speak last week, a lot of those folks who got in touch with him or got in touch with him through his publisher had not actually read the book, so didn't know what it was really about. He told us last week that he often would reach out to people who wrote to him and say, you know, can I talk to you a little bit about the book? And for the most part, people were not interested in engaging with him. They were just really upset about the title and were intending to take whatever action they were going to take, regardless of what he had to say, frankly.
So he's saying it's based on historical documentation. This is evidence. This is a piece of work chronicling something that's actually happened.
Yeah, exactly. So it was the Book of Negroes was a book about specific groups of Black Americans who immigrated to Canada after the American Revolution. And so their immigration records were documented broadly, and that was compiled in a book that was called the Book of Negroes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it speaks to the broader issue, which is that things that folks challenge in books or in other things, particularly in public libraries, often relate to the language that's used. And sometimes that language can be antiquated, and there can be very good reasons for using that language, whether it's because of a historical document, as in Lawrence Hill's case, or because a particular character in a novel comes from a particular time period where that word was common usage. And so often folks who get in touch with us are really uncomfortable with that language, because they feel it's stereotypical or it's racist, but it reflects a particular historical period. And our practice is not to censor unless something is found to be illegal in Canada. And so we'll make information available to people. We don't know why they might be reading it, right? They might be reading it to find out more about that historical period, not necessarily because they agree with a particular author or character in a book. And so we make stuff available that is part of people's free expression in Canada and their rights in Canada.
Mm-hmm. And I also kind of know a little bit about, like, Roald Dahl just also had mm-hmm. some of his works refurbished because of the antiquated language, like you said. But it was changes that people were kind of raising their eyebrows at. So I want to get to asking you about what some of the issues around censorship are like in Canada today, whether it's about that antiquated language or whether it's about approaching views that are different from your own. If you could tell me a little bit more about what we're looking at here.
So, I mean, broadly speaking, there have been trends across North American public libraries, so Canada and the US, where we've seen increasing challenges to material that's in public libraries. So I can kind of talk about the library context. I think we all know there's a broader social context, which sometimes follows the same trend, sometimes moves in slightly different directions. Reporting from last year, 2023, was actually reporting on 2022 data, if you're following me, but the Canadian Federation of Library Associations reported like the highest number of incidents of challenges since they started tracking in the early 2000s. So that's 2022 data. We're not totally in line with that, but also our data is a bit more up to date. So last year, 2023, here at OPL, we received 7 challenges to material in the collection, which is kind of on par with like the average we've had in the last decade. But we have had some spikes. We had a spike in the past 2 years, 2021 and 2022. So now it's coming back. It remains to be seen whether, you know, like we're going to continue on that kind of same average as we used to have, or if it's going to go up and down based on specific things that we see in society. Broadly speaking, challenges to material in North America relate to perspectives that are positive towards marginalized groups, particularly perspectives that are positive towards the LGBTQ community, and also kind of content that could be described as racist. So getting to your earlier point, a lot of that is material that has antiquated language or antiquated perspectives. Little House on the Prairie is another example, like Roald Dahl, that's often cited as being material that has some very outdated views about Indigenous Americans. Those are the two broad categories that we see being challenged across North America right now.
And I kind of want to pull a little bit more, if you can tell me about those 7 claims that the OPL faced. What were they specifically trying to address? Do you know off the top of your head?
We had kind of a broad range of different concerns that clients raised as part of those 7 challenges. So there were a couple where the concern was about racist content, a couple related to content that promoted hatred, that the client who put in the challenge believed the content promoted hatred, a couple of challenges for age inappropriate content. And that's a very common challenge category as well, one that we see across North America. And it can refer to anything from like, this is inappropriate for a child because it has sexual content, or this isn't appropriate for a child because it has antiquated views, et cetera. And then there were a couple of challenges each for violent, inaccurate, or objectionable content. So objectionable being a really broad category, right? Mm-hmm. Some challenges included, if you're counting, that is exactly 7, but some of them like had multiple concerns about the same title. So that's kind of what we saw in Ottawa. That's a bit of a grab bag of different categories. Nothing really jumped out. It wasn't like they were all related to one specific issue.
Mm, okay, I see. And then why is this freedom to read, this access to information, even stuff that we don't agree with, why is that important for Canadians, especially young Canadians?
Even young folks, even folks who are under the legal age of adulthood, have rights under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, right? So they have the right to access information that they might need, whether it's for school, for their own personal lives. They are undoubtedly hearing things on the schoolyard that are, I'm going to just guess, probably worse in many cases than the things you would see in a novel in the library. But it's really important for everybody, whether they're a young person or an older adult even, to be engaging with really difficult topics and difficult conversations as much as they are able to, you know, respecting their own mental health. But to kind of have the tools available in their toolbox to navigate complex topics and to engage with viewpoints that they might think are really disgusting or really dangerous or harmful or just wrong, right? That's part of what we call information literacy. And it's one of the things that we really champion at the public library, right? So having those tools to be able to navigate those conversations and those views in society equip you better for educational success, equip you better to be a member of a pluralist democracy, and just kind of equip you better to have Thanksgiving dinner with your family members, possibly, right? Because they might have very different views. We also know that, like, you know, there are certainly laws in Canada that relate to illegal content. And if a book is found to have violated those laws in Canada, it gets pulled. It most often gets pulled by the publisher before it gets pulled in a public library. But, you know, censoring material that is found to be legally acceptable, even if it is something that we really disagree with, censorship in general most often targets marginalized voices, but a commitment to free expression means that we're protecting all views, even the ones that we find potentially personally very odious.
Mm-hmm. And so you kind of mentioned earlier, but I just want to clarify, OPL's policy is that you'll only pull things off the shelf that aren't legal.
Correct. Yeah. So we have a what we call a content services framework, which is a guiding document for how we add items to our collection in the first place. So it needs to meet a number of different criteria in the framework before it gets added. We don't add everything that is published. So, you know, that might include community demand, representation, critical reviews. You know, there are professional guidelines that we follow before something gets added, as well as community interest, right? And then once it's in there, it could be pulled because it falls out of favor or fashion, right? So items that were published in 1982 and that talk about Pluto being a planet and are no longer being borrowed by anybody, they're not going to stay forever, right? We're not an archive in that respect. So things might get pulled as part of our regular review process and discarded, or, you know, if there is a lawsuit and someone is found to have violated the laws in Canada, that material would also get pulled. But as I said, that's very exceptional. And usually in instances like the two that I can think of in the 20th century history, it's often a letter from the publisher that comes first before a client complaint comes forward.
Gotcha. Okay. And so falling at the center of this kind of controversy, if I can call it that, of freedom to read, it's a lot of these books that are progressive thinking, that are helping people learn more about, like, social movements and issues that are taking place. But also these old books that we're talking about, I'm a fan of the classics and I'll be turning pages. And then you read something that you're like, oh, I can't believe the author actually just said that. But when it comes to censoring these issues, what happens when we only choose stories that are convenient or scrubbed clean and sanitized? What happens when we only use those stories and histories to inform society?
Yeah, I think, I mean, worst case scenario, right? We forget what that history was, right? We've essentially edited out the parts that we find uncomfortable or that we disagree with now. So God forbid you're a researcher looking back at early 21st century discourse, you won't know what it was because you won't have access to material anymore that reflects the diversity of views. But, you know, as I sort of alluded to earlier, on a more basic scale, if you're not seeing that content in a book, it's likely that there's at least one member of your community who still has those views, even though they may be kind of gross. And so, you know, being unable to engage with that person or address those views and say, no, that's wrong, and here's why, or I disagree with that, and here's why, you won't necessarily have those coping mechanisms unless you've been able to kind of engage with that content on some basis. And, you know, again, getting back to the main point, it doesn't reflect reality, right? What we see in our library collections, what we see in public discourse is what represents everyone's views in society. So I think not reflecting that is doing everyone a disservice ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so those were all the questions that I had for you today. I've learned a lot about Freedom to Read Week and information literacy and the opportunities to learn through public discourse. And it's interesting to see how these kinds of conversations unfold in real life. I appreciate you taking the time to walk me through that today.
Anytime. Happy to be on. And thanks for having me, Lauren.
Thanks so much, Alexandra.
Take care.